This is a closer look on 90.1 WABE, streaming live at WABE.org. Pleasure to have you along. I'm Dennis O'Hare.
And I'm Rose Scott. Take a listen to this. It's narrated by our own WABE senior reporter, Jim Burris.
Dear Greg, I expect you will be quite surprised to hear from me. If you remember me at all, it will likely be for unpleasant reasons. I was a classmate of yours at America's High School and graduated with you in 1965. I don't recall ever directly assaulting you, but I probably did to gain acceptance and accolades of my peers. In any case, I surely participated as part of an enabling audience and tacitly supported and encouraged those who did. For that, I am deeply sorry and regretful.
Now, that's part of a letter written to Greg Whitcamper from a former high school classmate, David Morgan. They attended America's High School in America's, Georgia, which is a little over 2 hours driving time south of Atlanta. The letter arrived 4 decades later from when they graduated, which was in 1965. But there's a lot more to this story, and it's told in a new book by former longtime at Journal Constitution reporter Jim Akbuti. And he joins us here in A Closer Look, as well as Greg Whitcamper. Gentlemen, thanks for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Rose. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Greg, I want to start with you. How would you describe life in America's, Georgia in 1965 for you?
My family moved to Koinonia Farm just as I was turning 6 years old. And the one thing that Koinonia didn't have was its own school system. So we went to the local schools. And in 65, I was a senior at America's High. And I was there my freshman and my junior years, and we kids from Koinonia were treated like we were lepers. It would be social suicide for a student to show us any empathy. And so we were isolated and tormented, kicked, spit on, everything you can imagine. And we all did our part. And in 65, it intensified because that was the year it was first integrated.
Let's back up a little bit. Why were you targeted in the first place?
Well, it was because of what Koinonia believed in. Koinonia was founded on racial equality, spiritual equality, and economic equality. It was a communal situation. And that didn't go over very well in South Georgia.
And just, again, sort of to explain it a little bit, Koinonia was kind of an experiment. This was a period of time when there was a lot of that going on. I mean, I think people think of the communes of the later 60s as some of the experiments that most people remember. But this was something that was going on way before that, wasn't it?
This was started in 1942 by Clarence Jordan. And when we moved there, there were quite a few families. It had grown to about 60 different, 60 people, maybe 8 different families.
So you just grew up there, and for you, life on the farm was, at least I'm sure as a little kid, you thought everybody lived like that, right?
Oh, it was great. When we moved there, there were tractors, and it was a thriving farming community. They had an egg business. Sold eggs all the way down to Albany, Georgia. It was a wonderful place to grow up. Going to school was when we realized we were different because the kids would refer to us as being from Koinonia Farm, and that set us off.
And so in 1965, when the high school is integrated, what was the reaction of the town?
Well, integration didn't go over very smoothly in a lot of places. And in 64, 65, there were 4 black students that came to the school, and I rode to school with them. I mean, they were my friends already, and I just did what was the natural thing to do, was to want to go to school with your friends. And there was an angry mob that threw rocks and bottles and we were actually quite afraid that we were going to get hurt. We didn't. But the harassment just kept on going for the whole year.
Greg, in reading your book, you took a lot of physical abuse as well. You took mental abuse, but you took some pretty hard beatings too.
Some. They were mostly afraid of me. I was a farm boy, and I never had anybody attack me personally. They always had a group around them, and they could never hit me more than once because I wouldn't fight back.
Real quickly, before we get to Jim and how he was drawn into the story, how long did you go through the abuse that you were just talking about for accompanying African-American students to school? So how long did that sort of harassment last?
Well, I went there as a freshman, and it lasted my whole freshman year. I got a little breather. I went away to North Dakota to another community my family went to. That's another story. But I came back for my junior year, and all of my junior year I was isolated and tormented, and then all of my senior year.
And at your graduation, you were booed, weren't you?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
You walk across the stage and...
When I got my diploma, there was as many boos as there were cheers.
Did you try to change people's minds, or did you withdraw? In other words, people have different responses to that kind of treatment. So what was yours?
My response was, I imagined myself in a bubble. I would get off, I would get onto the school grounds, and I would imagine myself being in a bubble that I didn't go out of, and I didn't feel anybody come back in on. So I basically just was there.
Did it make it hard for you to make friends among the African-American students, too, or did you hang out with them?
Oh, no, they were my friends before they came to school. I took part in the civil rights demonstrations and those kind of things. And so they were my friends when we got to school. And
Were they protection in a way? And I don't mean in a physical sense. I mean in terms of support.
Well, they were definitely my support system, but the problem was I didn't get to see them because they weren't seniors, and they arranged it so that they would come to school 5 minutes late while everybody was in class. They would change classes 5 minutes early, and then they would leave school 5 minutes early so that they were never between classrooms with the other students. They wouldn't allow me to do that, but they did that to lessen the violence.
Jim, I want to bring you... Thank you, Graham. Sorry, my apologies. Jim, I want to bring you in here. How did you hear about Greg's story? I know you've done a lot of writing on the South and race relations.
Well, I've known the Koinonia story for a long time. One of the first out-of-town assignments I had with the Journal Constitution in the fall of 1980 was to go down to Koinonia. Clarence Jordan's widow, Florence, was still alive, and I interviewed her, and you could still see bullet holes in the buildings where the Klan had ridden by and shot at them. One thing, Greg, there was a great depth of animosity toward Koinonia in the 1950s and 60s. Koinonia was terrorized in the 50s because of their belief in racial equality, and their farm market was bombed twice by the Klan. A feed and seed store in downtown Americus that was selling them stuff got bombed. Greg, when he was 9 years old, was shot at when he was out playing volleyball with some of the other kids from the farm one night. They tried to assassinate Clarence Jordan in the house that he lived in there. There was a lot of violence against that community. And so when the civil rights movement mobilized in southwest Georgia in 1961 in Albany and then spread later, a couple of years later, to Americus, Koinonia was allies of theirs. And so these people, the reason these people didn't like Greg in school, it really wasn't personal. It was what he stood for. He came from this community that was considered an enemy camp, and he was considered a traitor to his race. He was the representation of all the things that they didn't like that were changing about American society.
But it wasn't just me. It was also other kids from Koinonia. My brother went there before I did. He was a year ahead of me. And there was Jan Jordan and Laura Brown and my brother David, who was younger than me. So we all got the same treatment.
It wasn't just Greg, but Greg was the only Koinonia kid at America's High School in the fall of 1964 when it admitted a handful of black students. Therefore, it all came down on him.
Greg, what year did you leave America's, and did you have a feeling of, I'm leaving, I'm never coming back to this place?
Mm-hmm. No, my parents lived there, and I went back, and I always met new people, and Koinonia was always a very vibrant place where people were coming and going. So I enjoy going back to Koinonia.
Let's fast forward a little bit, a lot, actually. It's decades later, and you get a letter from David Morgan. Tell me what went through your mind when you got that letter.
Well, it was pretty mind-blowing to open the letter that... first one I got was an invitation to
the class reunion.
Class reunion, and that pretty much blew me away. I was going, wow! I never thought I would be invited to one of these things. And then the next letter I opened was a letter that was read earlier, or part of it. And then the next day I got several more, and out of a class of 100. I think by then maybe 10 had passed away, and I got almost a dozen letters from students, and they were all being apologetic to the way they had acted. And that was that I actually had to just stop the car and cry for a while. It was so emotional. I still get emotional thinking about it.
And you had to think then about, how do I respond? Did you have any idea at first? Because as much as we all like to think we're above bitterness and so forth when we're treated that way, did you have any of, I told you so, I want to get back at you, I want to put you in your place? Or was it that, you know, what we'd all like to think was, I'm instantly going to feel good and forgive?
If it would have happened soon afterwards, you know, maybe even 5-10 years, I probably would have responded with, you got a lot of nerve to be my friend, you know.
The Bob Dylan song,
yeah.
Positively 4th Street.
Yeah, right. I would have felt that way.
And that's in the book, actually.
Yeah, it is. But after 40 years, I had worked through it. In the book, it describes this whole process a little more fully, and I shouldn't go into it all now. But
tell us a little bit about it, though, what you walked through to get to whatever response you ultimately had.
Well, basically, it took time, and I was in Sweden. I went off to school, and I was away from home, and I had this dream that I was actually shooting these students with a machine gun. And I woke up, and I had this great relief. Well, about a year later, I was in Africa at the time, and I had the same dream again. But this time, it seemed so real that when I woke up, I was so relieved that it was a dream that my animosity just disappeared because of my relief that I really wasn't hurting them.
The morning of the reunion, your emotions, did you go back and forth with, I'm going to go, I'm not going to go?
Well, I joked about it. We were driving down to the reunion, and I joked to my wife, well, we can always turn around. But no, once I got the letters from students, I was convinced that they were real, and that I really wanted to meet them and see.
What happened when you walked in and you saw them?
Well, one of the fellows that came up and gave me a hug and was crying. So, you know, 75% of the students came up and said they were sorry. Another 25% were a little more standoffish still, but I was really happy that so many of them expressed real concern that they hadn't hurt me.
Jim, how long did it take to capture all this? So you had a number of interviews and a lot of research. How long did it take to write this book?
Well, I wrote a story for the Journal Constitution about it in 2006, and then I went back to my day job. And Greg and I kind of knew we were going to do a book from the get-go, but I didn't leave the newspaper until 2009 and started working on it then, along with some other projects. It probably took 2 or 3 years of concentrated effort, but I had a lot of interruptions. I mean, the thing that really, elevates this story for me is that it isn't just about ugly things that happened in the South half a century ago. It's about how people change and about how minds and hearts can evolve. And it's about our capacity for change and reconciliation. I think there's some uplift at the end.
There's also a process, though. Somebody has to realize that, I mean, even as Dr. King said so often, what the hard part is not just the actions of the bad people, but the silence of the good people. That doesn't happen in some little, you know, instant movie feel-good kind of thing. I'll start with Jim and then Greg to you about the process, trying to describe that process for people, both the victims and the offenders.
The people who wrote letters to Greg were by and large not people who had spit on him or who had done things directly to him in high school. They were the good kids who knew better, who stood by. In a couple of cases, they kind of scoffed. They were on the edge of the peanut gallery and laughed. But mostly they stood by while these things were happening. These were the very picture of the people that Martin Luther King Jr. wrote the letter to from the Birmingham jail to, the white people of the South who knew better and weren't saying anything. That's the people. The people who really bedeviled Greg in high school were a minority. It was all the other people who sort of stood by and allowed it to happen who felt bad about it all those years later. And a great deal of this book is actually tracing their evolution. How did they broaden their minds? How did they go from being children of segregation in Americas to being people who would write these eloquent letters of forgiveness and to have had a change of heart like that?
So did you get a sense it was just a maturation process for them, or did they go out and experience, you know, as you leave a small town like that and you get out to the rest of the world, you realize that the world is made up of a lot of different people, a lot of different races and backgrounds. Did you gather that from the people that had terrorized Greg for those years?
That's exactly what happened to him. They all got out and saw some of the world. One of them went into the Navy. One of them went to college and pretty soon found himself teaching black students at a community college in Alabama and starting to be responsible for their well-being, which completely changed his outlook. Another one married and moved to Norfolk, Virginia, where she was around a bunch of military personnel. Another one was in Charleston, South Carolina, and started selling Tupperware, and she was in a military area too and found herself selling Tupperware to a lot of black families where she was having to encounter them in a completely different way than she had ever done in Americas. They all got out and broadened their minds and saw the world and went through the same sort of changes that a lot of people in America had to do in those years.
Greg, one of the questions for me listening to it all and reading what I could of the book is, okay, what about your friends that you rode with, those African-American students? When it came time for the reunion, what happened with them?
Well, they weren't part of my class. They were underclassmen.
Okay.
So they weren't part of the class that I was in. I don't think any of them have ever been. Robertina ended up graduating from America's High, and the last I talked to her, she had never been to one of the reunions.
Had she been, or do you know? You may not know. Had she ever even been invited?
I don't know.
Yeah.
To this point, I don't think so. No. At the time we wrote the book, she hadn't been.
No, she hadn't been invited, and she's a pretty prominent person, actually, and she's pretty easy to find, so no. Yeah. I think it's fair to say that most of the black students have not been extended the same forgiveness and reconciliation that Greg has, and we deal with that some at the end of the book, and that's the glass half-empty part of this.
Greg, as we wrap up, a moment ago you talked about how emotional it is for you to even still recall many of those events, but as you've gotten older as well, what do you tell people who say, well, you know, that was at the time. And often we'll hear that was the time and you can't blame people for their actions because that was the time. But what do you say to people about forgiveness in terms of, if you believe that, in terms of not holding grudges or not letting something consume you for decades and decades and finding peace if you found peace? Have you found peace?
I think I have. I don't have the animosity. we only do what we know, and most of what they did was fear. And if the fear element wouldn't have been there, it wouldn't have been so intense. But like one of the girls said, if I would have shown you any kindness, my father could have lost his job.
In that way, does the process of forgiving lead to understanding? There's a difference, I think, between understanding and excusing. So did you have to go through a process of that and saying, well, what if I had been in their position? Would I have acted differently?
Well, I say in the book that if I felt at the time even that if we had been switched in our cribs,
yeah,
that I would have played their role, they would have played mine. And it's just by the grace of God that we get the lot dealt to us that we get.
Greg Whitcamper, who is the subject of Jim Akmuti's book, The Class of 65, A Student, A Divided Town, and the Long Road to Forgiveness. Gentlemen, thanks so much for coming in and taking the time.
Well, thank you, Rose. Can we mention that we're doing a book talk and signing at the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library tonight at 7 o'clock?
I think you just did.
No, you can't mention that. We'll just keep it between us. How's that?
Thank you very much.
Thank you all so much.